better put him in the Heisman.
Got that wood right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light, proud sponsor of Arkansas Athletics.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team is on the way back. A College World Series title. The Bomb Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast.
Well, I guess we got to welcome in this guy. His name is Clay Henry. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was in all the papers, but he's one of the most well-known, probably well-educated person in Razorback sports, especially Razorback football, and he's going to be joining us again every Monday and Friday, and he joins us here now.
You read it just like he wrote it.
I know. Well, no, here's the thing, and Clay, I got to apologize to you. I had a big pomp and circumstance type of intro for you. But with some timing with our voice guy and everything, I don't have it ready for you today. Well, do not fret. I will have it ready for you, and we can properly introduce you on Monday, I promise.
Can we have, like, George Strait music, like...
Amen.
You know, the old troubadour?
Yes, like amen. That? Amen. Anything George Strait's got to be good.
Oh, it is good. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll tell this story. I was taking Becca fishing about 10 years ago, and I just got a new George Strait gift pack. It was a two discs, and my truck had, you know, you can put three discs in there. So I just had those two, and it was 50 number ones. They're all 50 of the songs on there were number one hits, mm-hmm. George Strait.
Yeah.
And so we'd play a song, and I said, now, Becca, tell me if you think this was number one or not. She said, well, yeah, that one was. A little bit later, the next one. No, that one's not. And we went back and forth like that for 2.5 hours as we drove to the river, and we pulled into the parking lot at Bull Shoals Dam, and I said, like, Becca, every one of those were number
yep.
ones.
It's like reading an Alabama media guide. They're all number ones. All right, let's get to some football. Here as we're at day one of fall camp. They call it fall camp, but it's training camp, getting ready for the season. We're inside the month of the first game. Clay, there's a lot of anticipation and excitement, but you know these first couple of practices will get underway today and tomorrow. What are you anticipating? What do you think in the limited time we'll get to see, and then what we'll hear from Coach Morris after practice today? What are you expecting will happen on day one?
Well, it's first of all, day one, I think Houston Nutt was the first one that said this to me, and it's true. Day one is gym class. I mean, they don't have full pads on. It's not real
right.
football. It's just, it's glorified 7-on-7 with, you know, it's organization, and the NCAA mandates that. They want to roll you in gently. And, you know, it's always, I'll never forget this either, is there'll be somebody that, you know, gets his eligibility a day or two later. I don't know that there's anybody in this group. I think they're all good to go. But, you know, like if there's a junior college player and he comes out 4 days later, well, then it's like, okay, he's got to be in shorts. He's got to have 2 days of the mandated no pads, which was always like crap to me. I mean, why let him play football? He's chomping on the bits. It's not like,
yeah,
like he's not ready. But today will be shorts, running, you know, trying to, you know, they'll throw the ball around a little bit more because, you know, there's not really much in the running game. But here's what we're going to be doing, guys, every single day. Whatever we get to see, it will be, okay, Nick Starkel did this, but Ben Hicks did that. The players reacted this way to Starkel, they reacted this way to Hicks. I mean, we're going to be trying to measure and dice this up, how this quarterback race is going on, and that's what it's, you know, that's what it's going to be. We're planning, of course, Media Day is tomorrow, for, you know, and that's when you get your pictures, and so we're setting up our next cover for Hogs Illustrated. You can have Nick Starkel and Ben Hicks side by side, you know, given that glare. And I was talking to Kyle Parkinson. He said, their dance card's pretty full. That's what everybody's going to shoot, so I'm going to do something else. I'm not telling you what else, what I'm going to do, but our cover will be slightly different than that. So did I answer that question?
I think you answered a lot of questions right there, even ones we haven't asked yet. So, you know,
look, I'm sorry.
Here's the thing. You talk about the – oh, that's fine. That's fine. That's why we have Clay Henry on the show here. Hey, one of the things, you know, they roll – we talk about these non-padded practices, this acclimation that you have to start camp. In years gone by, there's been good reason because players had to come to camp and report, and that's when you kind of started some of the conditioning. Now you're there all summer. You've been having player-led practices all summer. Have we reached a day in time, and this isn't unique to Arkansas, you know, every program across the country is having these player-led practices and the off-season training. Have we reached a point where maybe the first few days of practice and the way you go about it need to be revisited because players are in better shape? They are better acclimated to heat. They are better acclimated to conditions. Is this the most productive and best way to start camp now that players report in the best shapes of their lives on day one?
Yeah, I think you got a point there. And I'm sure the coaches have petitioned that. And the administrators and the guys that make the rule and the competition committee, all that kind of, you know, all those kind of good, you know, people that lay down the rules, they just want to make sure. And football has had its share of, you know, black eyes, so to speak, the deaths or the concussions and all that stuff. So they're, I think they probably get to hit enough, but it just kind of frustrates me. I want to see it on the first day, and so do the coaches, but I get it. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to go in slowly, but yeah, these guys are like NFL teams and that they have had practices all summer. It's mandatory voluntary. And <Yeah. laughs> the coaches are involved in the aspect of they get daily feedback from their leaders and captains, and they are able to meet with the team one day a week to kind of give them some structure. So, yeah, they could probably put the pads on the first day, but I understand why they do it that way. And it's you know, a model that's handed down to, you know, all the high school teams. I suppose they don't put pads on the very first day either, you know, in high school.
No,
Tommy, you may
don't.
Know more about that than I do. So that's standard.
It's very, very similar
operating
model.
Well, I know, Clay, that since we talked a little bit last night, or I should say you talked a little bit last night about some of the things also that we were going to discuss today too. And getting into that, because it seems like with practice starting up today and with media day tomorrow, the question has been asked about access for the media and if they have enough access or should they be getting access, should they be able to watch practices. And this has been an ongoing conversation, I know, with some of the media members here in this state. I want your thought on it. What do you feel like the media should have more access than what they do now to the Razorback football team, to practices, to players, and all of that?
Okay, I'm going to give you two answers. The one is, as a journalist, as somebody that's done it for basically 50 years, I'm 65, I started going to practices when I was 15, 16, I would say, yes, we need to have more access, in that, you know, we're professionals and we can, you know, we can hold in check what we see and filter it, and we know what's on the record, off the record, you know, the things, you know, hey, if there's a fight, you're not supposed to report that, and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm going to give you my answer if I'm the head coach at University of Arkansas or Alabama or LSU or Arizona or Southern Cal. No, you don't let media in. It's grown to a point that there are 21, 22-year-olds blogging, and they bring their cell phones, and one of them invariably mm-hmm. is decided that he's going to break something that gets him 20,000 clicks in 30 seconds. And he films the Statue of Liberty play that they've been working on for 2 weeks but haven't shown in a game yet. And now, is that going to happen often? No. And that guy will be done. But he doesn't care. He got what he wanted, and it's like, all right, now I'm back at the student newspaper. And I'm not saying anybody with the traveler would do that, but I'm talking about the different outlets around, you know, different schools. You got somebody in there that is not a professional journalist yet, but he is in the fact that he's got a cell phone and he can yep. download video, and he's doing it. And the coaches are paranoid, and that's not going to change because they can't control who is, you know, a young media person that has got a block. I mean, there's a new one blossoming almost every day, and they come to practice, and the communication staff is kind of juggling. Well, we let this guy in. Well, yeah, we're going to let him all in. We want publicity, but we're going to let him do the things that we can control, the message, but we're not going to just turn them loose at practice, you know, for a scrimmage. So that's why it is, guys. And you know, and I know there's been stories written about letting fans in. Well, I mean, they got a cell phone, and if they hold it down by their waist, just right at their side, and you don't see it's out there and it's recording, and, you know, and then that guy puts it on, you know, a message board or whatever, now they've become the reporters. And so the only way you can control that is you don't let them in. And I hate it, but it's if I was a coach, I would be operating the same exact way. Now, you take myself, Dudley Dawson, Richard Davenport, Tom Murphy, Bob Holt. Are we going to, you know, can the coaches tell us what the rules are and we go by them? Yeah. But you can't, there's 30 more, and some of them are just newbies. And you just, and the coaches are like, I don't know what that guy's fixing to do. He's out here. I don't even know who he is. And it just makes them just like their skin crawl, knowing what, you know,
paranoia.
What could happen.
Yeah.
Does it happen? Yeah. That word should be in the definition of coach. About the fourth thing in the dictionary, yeah. It should have, comma, paranoia. Because that's what they are. And I don't, yeah. I'm not, and well, it didn't matter whether you're talking about University of Arkansas, a college football coach, the high school coaches are paranoid too. I mean, yeah. It's like they're looking, they're coaching basketball in the gym and they're looking over there. Who's watching us?
Yeah. And, my dad had an old saying, said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way coaches view it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good comparison.
So Lewis Campbell told me the story about he was coaching at Alabama right out of the bat. You know, he was a GA. Bear Bryant and Frank Burrell swapped GAs. And he's at Alabama, and the defensive coordinator called him in and said, hey, we're going to work on this week. You know, they're playing Tennessee. And he's like, Coach, they hadn't showed that on film. He goes, yeah, but they practiced it last week. He goes, well, how do you know? And he says, well, I got six guys at Tennessee that can get in Neyland Stadium, and they're in the cracks and the croonies. And he had a spiral notebook, and each page – there was a school, and on it was 20 names and phone numbers of a local high school coach that would go by and call him with whatever was happening that week at that school they were fixing to play. He had spies.
Yeah. Mm.
And so you think they're not paranoid? They are, because they're doing it.
You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light, proud sponsor of Arkansas Athletics.
Everybody's staying home. Now he does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're at number three, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
The defensive ends might be one of those positions to where Arkansas really hasn't had an effective one since, what, Dietrich Wise? He's probably been the most effective defensive end, but it was a stretch there where it certainly seemed like defensive end was a strong position for Arkansas. You had Trey Flowers before that. You had Chris Smith. You had Jake Beckett. You had some guys that were really pivotal on having those defenses stay alive, and Arkansas is going to need one of these guys to step up and be that guy.
And, Clay, this year you're able to move Sosa Aguim inside where he probably is a better pro prospect there. I'd like your thoughts on that, but you've got about five guys here you think you can rotate at defensive end, and I guess Dorian Gerald's probably the name that most of our listeners are most familiar with this morning.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that some of these guys have not been much factors. Gerald was overweight last year when he got here, junior college player, had not been in the weight program, completely redid his body over the winter and the summer, and he's about 15 pounds lighter, and it's all muscle. But it's not so much the body. It's learning the proper technique and being able to sustain things for three or four plays. And I think when you're in junior college, it's like, I'm going to wait till third down, and I'm going to rush the passer. And you can't do that. You got to play on first down and second down and play the run. And he got a lot better. Gabe Richardson was a guy that's been here 2 years, but he just hadn't been effective. And it seemed like he didn't really understand the system last year. They finally just took him off the field. But he had a great spring. And then Jamario Bell, who's the guy that's played four or five different positions on defense, and he really showed signs the last 2 weeks of spring of being that difference maker that everybody thought, 6'5", length, speed, kind of freaky. And his technique's gotten better. And then you've got the young players, Matteo Soli, who is he's 4'4", or better, and he's gained about 25 pounds since he's been here. His daddy, Junior, coached him in high school, came from a great program. His technique and understanding the maturity of what it's going to be like here, he's been prepared marvelously by Junior. He will be a factor this year, and he has that burst. If you remember what they had at Texas A&M, those two ends that were first-rounders, that's what he's got. He's not quite ready to be drafted in the first round, but he probably will be there at some point. And then Zach Williams is another one. He's 245, 248, got room for another 15 pounds. So that's the core group that you can play with at defensive end, and Steve Caldwell is excited.
Yeah. And you look at, you mentioned that group, three seniors. We talked about Sosa Gein moving inside. That gives you another senior on that defensive line to work together as a unit. I like the fact that you got a lot of upperclassmen that are going to be, putting their hand in the dirt, as they say, when it comes to it on Saturday. And generally, that's part of the ingredients to win in this league, is you better have a lot of juniors and seniors if they're not elite players. If they're not first-rounders, you better have some experienced guys. And Arkansas does have some experience, at least, on that defensive line.
I think you're right. And T.J. Smith is another one who's a senior. He's only 282, but his body fat is way down there for a defensive lineman. And his strength, pound for pound, he's got it. Then you've got Jonathan Marshall, who Trumaine Carroll, I asked the other day, I said, who out of the whole team would you say you could label freak athlete? And, I mean, he didn't pause. It was Jonathan Marshall. And I don't know what squat lifts and power clean. I don't know what is good. But I think if they don't have enough room on the ball for the 50-pound circles, that's pretty good. And when you're doing 600-pound lifts, 500-pound bench, and your body fat is low, it's the challenge with Jonathan Marshall is to get him to play with the right technique. In other words, play with pad level and play under people, not just stand up and get knocked back. So he's got to prove that his technique is going to be consistent play after play, and that's what to watch for. But then you've got Isaiah Nichols, who's a redshirt freshman. Maybe he played some last year. I don't know. He's a young player that they're really excited about and will be in the rotation and is a terrific talent. So they're okay inside too. I don't think this defensive line is an SEC defensive line. And then there's a lot of young guys that we're waiting to see how they fit. So the model that Chad Morris has in Arkansas is the same model that Clemson have, 18 to 22 defensive linemen. And depth, young players developing, and just keep bringing in those four stars in the defensive line. And you saw last year in the national championship game, I think Clemson lost their, one of their best defensive linemen before the championship game. I think he was declared ineligible for substance abuse or something, PEDs. And you didn't notice, they just plugged another guy in. Didn't matter. And that's where you've got to get to, and that's where Auburn, that's where – Alabama, and that's where LSU and Georgia, the defensive lines are dominant. And I think with Steve Caldwell recruiting, you're going to continue to have these type players. I mean, there's two or three more that they're on this year that looks like they're going to get.
Well, see, and that's the thing, Clay, is that when I was analyzing and going through all the roster spots and looking at position groups, to me, the defensive line not only has a lot of depth there, it seems to be a lot of its quality depth, and it has a good mixture of seniors and then true freshmen that are really talented, and then you mentioned having Steve Caldwell into the mix as well. I could be wrong about this, but I just feel like this has really good potential to possibly be the best position group on the Razorback football team this year because of the talent, the depth, and the coaching that all goes hand-in-hand with it.
Yeah, I like the defensive line group, and I really like the running back group. You know, the experience and the talent. Amonte Spivey, we haven't seen anything about, but he's from Phoenix City, Alabama. And everybody raves about him, the body and the speed. And then you know you've got Devwa Whaley and Rakeem Boyd, 1A, 1B, however you want to list those two. Chase Hayden's pretty good. You know, he was hurt in the spring game, and we really didn't get to see what he was like earlier in the spring, but there were times the coaches really thought Chase Hayden came on. And the good thing about those running backs is they seem to understand the pass blocking. And there was so much criticism of the offensive line last year. I played golf with Joe Craddock on Monday, and he told me that the thing that we as sports writers and fans maybe didn't grasp, but a lot of those sacks were because the quarterback didn't get the ball out quick enough or the backs went the wrong way and didn't protect the edge. And you see two guys coming off the edge, and the tackle takes one of them, and there's a guy coming out outside of him, and you think, well, the tackle didn't get the right guy. Well, it was the running back. So, you know, all the things but I think this running back group to me is like the defensive line group, right kind of talent and the right blend of experience.
McTelvin, again, let's talk about him on the inside, making that move, and he's played both inside and outside on that defensive line. Obviously, it's his last go, Clay, and this is a guy highly heralded when they recruited him in here. Probably one of the best pro prospects, wouldn't you say, on the defensive side of the ball?
Oh, no doubt. And he is a pro prospect if he plays inside. And he's got his body right, a little more weight, because he knew he was going to play inside. That's been always the deal. He thought he was a defensive end, and he resisted for a long time. Hey, I can remember getting a call from a guy in the NFL that kind of screens the draft for a team, and it's a guy that you'd recognize the name. I guess it was 3 years ago, and he was checking on Dietrich Wise and a couple of other guys that were on the Arkansas defensive line. And he'd watched every tape. Now, what he was calling me is like, hey, what kind of character is this guy? He wasn't asking me if they could play, but it's like, how are they to deal with? Are they personable? Or how do their teammates like them? They're just doing all this background check. And I get this call whenever I got a call. When Trey Flowers and Darius Phylon came out, and this team had both of those guys rated high, they didn't get them. I said, well, what about number three? You know, with Sosa again. He's like, oh, well, he's a great talent, but he's playing out of position. I was like, well, what? He said, he needs to be inside. He can be a difference maker inside. He is not a defensive end. He doesn't have the speed or the length in his arms to play defensive end at the NFL level. But if they'll move him inside, and that's what he said about him as a freshman. And it's, you know, I guess that's what the coaches recognized almost immediately, but he wanted to play defensive end. He's all bought in at tackle because he knows there's been enough feedback that you are inside at the next level. He wants to go show it.
He wants that defensive end money.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between tackle money and end money at the next level.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that most of those guys don't want. If you play at tackle inside, you're going to get double teamed. And it's just not as much fun as playing outside where I'm going to run around the offensive tackle. But you better be able to run around the offensive tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't do that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why they call it a skill position anymore,
right?
Defensive end. So,
Yeah, sometimes I never like to play inside at defensive tackle either, guys.
Yeah, well, sometimes the best athletes on the field are on the defensive end. And I mean, they need somebody to step up this year, but they'll have some depth there.
You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light, proud sponsor of Arkansas Athletics.
Give is to Alex Collins, straight up the middle, and Collins on the run. They won't catch him. Alex Collins is going to take it all the way to the house. Touchdown, Arkansas, 80 yards.
When we were looking at key games for the Arkansas Razorbacks in 2019, I think the game that gets mentioned by us at least more than anything is that Ole Miss game in week two. I think it's pretty obvious of why that game. It's almost like, and I don't want to put it so lightly, but it's almost like the winner of that game doesn't finish last. It's kind of the battle for the last in the SEC West. Because it has that feeling where both teams are not picked to be very good this year.
Yeah, well, and for Arkansas, it's a huge game because it's your first chance to win an SEC game, and it's your first chance to get that monkey off of your back, that moniker of 0-8, then becomes 0-9. You know, it took a while into Brett Bielema's second campaign to get that win over LSU on that call. So you got to get that behind you. You know, and I think that's one thing you would know. You're not going to have an 0-4 season. Mm-hmm. It puts you in a position for a bowl game. That's why that Ole Miss game's so huge. And like you said, of all the Western Division games, it's pretty clear that's the most winnable, even though it's on the road.
Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that, at least for Arkansas, and I'm sure Ole Miss feels the same way, that it's so early in the season because, you know, at least Arkansas especially, they're still trying to figure out their team, and they will be by that point. They're still got brand-new quarterbacks, offensive linemen. You know, you always want to make sure that those most key games are later in the season, at least in most cases. But we also mentioned the Texas A&M game, and I think that's a big one too. But let me throw another one in here, Tommy, and I'll explain it. Missouri might be my second biggest key game for Arkansas. Well, and the reason being is because, of course, that being the final game of the season, it's always going to be bigger than anything because it's going to dictate, okay, at that point, and then going to that final game, a lot of cases it could be for a team. You win this game, it's the difference between going to Nashville for the Music City Bowl or going to Birmingham. You know, it can be things like that. Or it can be for winning the division or winning the SEC, whatever it is. But for this year for Arkansas, I feel like at that point in time, that might be the game that's going to decide if Arkansas goes to a bowl game or not.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably going to be some severe consequence at the end of the year. Like I said, you hope to be in a position where that's either got you in a bowl game or you're trying to elevate your bowl status. Be nice to think you already have six wins or more going into that game. That may not be a realistic thought at this point. But, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot on the line in Little Rock the day after Thanksgiving just simply because you're probably trying to play your way into bowl eligibility or you're trying to elevate your bowl status.
Yeah. And Missouri, they may be in a similar situation where, you know, depending on if they get eligible for postseason, that could be their bowl game if they still have to be banned from postseason play.
Yeah, assuming they win their appeal. You know, Vegas has them at 8.5 over-under on wins.
Schedule's favorable.
Schedule sets up nice for them. But nobody's schedule that is at 8 or 9 or 10 or, you know, A&M or any – all of these teams have Arkansas scheduled. So if Arkansas wins the Missouri game, the Ole Miss game, the A&M game, or keep going, it's just what degree of an upset it's going to be.
Yep.
And for a lot of other teams, it's going to be in their fan base's eyes – depending on what point in the season, how Arkansas has played out, an embarrassing loss that the coach is going to have to deal with that's going to turn the heat up on some coaches if Arkansas is able to pull some upsets this year. Unfortunately, that's where Arkansas is at right now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And another thing that I want to add into it, Tommy, and this is kind of crazy. I'm having to double-check it here on the fly before I make the point because, again, I want to make sure I get it right. But Arkansas and play, guys, two SEC games in Fayetteville this year. Craig,
right.
Rom, right?
Auburn and Mississippi State.
That's right. So they have those two games.
The A&M game is technically one of your home games at Arlington, and then the Missouri game at the end of the year is in Little Rock. So the two Fayetteville games are Auburn and Mississippi State.
And knowing that, and this is what's crazy about it, Tommy, do you realize that the last SEC game that Arkansas has won in Fayetteville, mind you, in Fayetteville, was Ole Miss of 2016.
Wow.
Because
it just goes to show you, but that's 16. We're in 19.
Yes. Yes.
There was a 17 and an 18 season.
That's right. That's right. Because obviously in 17, the only SEC victory they got that year was against Ole Miss, but that was on the road.
Right.
Last year they went 0-4. And if you don't win one of those SEC games this year against Auburn, Mississippi State, which are going to be difficult games, you're looking at
three straight years of zero SEC wins in Fayetteville.
Nothing's going to be easy against Auburn. No. We were talking about them earlier with Clay. You know, mature lines, a defensive line that's going to be amongst the best in the SEC. With Auburn, their question is at quarterback, of course, but they're going to be a good, they're going to be a better team on paper, and than Arkansas is going to be, and Mississippi State is too. Now, State's the more winnable of those two games, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's that's hard to believe. I hadn't even thought of that point.
Yeah.
You just made it. 2016 was the last time you had a home game in Fayetteville result in a Razorback SEC victory.
Right, and sorry, Florida actually happened after Auburn, but still the same principle. It was still 2016.
Still the same year.
Yeah, still the same year. So it's been that long since Arkansas has gotten a victory against an SEC foe in Fayetteville. And we know that home field advantage means a lot, but if you – I'm trying to grasp my mind around it, and just when you put it that way, that you have a chance to go three straight years without an SEC victory in Fayetteville.
And you wonder why you're having trouble selling tickets.
Exactly. I mean, it all goes hand in hand.
Well, that's why winning cures everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's critical, I think, to get one of those two games. Now that you put it in that light, it's critical that one of those two, the Auburn and the Mississippi State game, results in a win. I don't think they're the most winnable games, but, gosh, that is –
you almost got to win one of them, though. That's the crazy thing.
Incredible.
And, I mean, you got to win one of them. Now, we know in 2020 – the home schedule really gets good for Arkansas, especially in SEC play, because then they not only get Alabama, LSU, and Ole Miss in Fayetteville. I'm trying to remember. It's either – is it might be Tennessee that's in Fayetteville? I'll have to double-check on that. But they have a really good SEC schedule coming to Fayetteville that year.
Next year's schedule's really, you know, really good as far as on paper. But those even-numbered years when Bama and LSU come in, I think it makes it more difficult in some ways because those in recent times and in – the state of the SEC West, those aren't winnable games. So, you know, if you're getting three games at home, four games at home in SEC play, gosh, you get Bama and LSU, that just takes, you know, in most cases, the likelihood of winning that down. Now, I know they won in, 15, they beat LSU.
Yeah.
But they haven't had a lot of success since 2011 against LSU other than that 15 game. I don't think they've won.
Well, in 2014 they won.
Which one was it? Was Bielema's first year?
Bielema's first year was 2013, where they should have won.
His first SEC win
was 2014.
14 against them, all right.
And they won in 15, going down to Baton Rouge. So they won those two games. But here's the thing, though. In 2012, 2013, those two games should have been in Arkansas's favor, too. So, you know, you just look at all these games that have happened between those two opponents, and it's kind of the same thing. So Ed Orgeron, since he's arrived, though, has had no problem with Arkansas, pretty much.
Should have won in 13 against him when they
let
the guy get behind him
exactly
at the end of the game. So
that success that you've had against LSU has not been recent.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So but it was
just my point is those even-numbered years when Bam and LSU, everybody loves that schedule, but it doesn't make it easier to win at home is my point.
No. And in fact, Tennessee, by the way, Tommy, is the game that Arkansas will have in Fayetteville in 2020.
That's good.
So, I mean, that's
a winnable game as it appears right now.
I mean, Tennessee, Ole Miss, Alabama, and LSU being all in Fayetteville next year, I think that'll be pretty satisfactory.
The last time Tennessee and Arkansas played was in Knoxville, and Arkansas won that game.
Yeah, that was a weird game.
Well, they were down 14-0 early. It was a wet night.
Mm-hmm.
I was at that game, and Arkansas did what generally is the unthinkable. They came back from two touchdowns behind early in the game to win on the road. That just doesn't happen often in the SEC.
Well, the thing is when I look at that, I kind of feel more like it was about which team was going to screw up, which coach was going to choke first. It was just Butch Jones was the one that choked first in that one before Brett Bielema. That was kind of a battle of the choke artist there for coaches for sure. So, yeah, but it's just when you put it all in perspective a lot of times, it makes you really sad if you're a Razorback fan knowing all the things that have gone against you over the past few years. So there's obviously every game's going to be crucial, but there are some games that you feel like will be even more crucial. So if you had to rank them, Tommy, would you have Ole Miss at one as being the most key game this year for Arkansas?
I think it is because it's early. And it sets the path. A win there sets a path up for a 4-0 start for the Razorbacks. Helps sell some tickets for those third and fourth games in your stadium in Fayetteville, which the program, I don't say desperately needs, but they're struggling to sell tickets, which is still like the biggest slice of the revenue pie.
Mm-hmm.
Selling your tickets. I know you get a lot of money from the SEC, but selling tickets is still very, very important.
And
the anticipation it could possibly bring for that A&M game in Arlington would be huge. So I think the Ole Miss game is key because it gets the 0-8 thing off your back right away. puts that to bed. It really sets you up to be potentially bowl eligible. There's just so many things that it opens up with a win there.
Yeah. So you got Ole Miss, and then after, are you going to say A&M's the second?
Well, now that you put it in the light of how long it's been since you've won an SEC game at Fayetteville, is Mississippi State or Auburn now second? Now, I think for the games I would like to win, it would be the A&M game.
For sure.
It's been too long. It'd be good to win in Texas over a Texas team in A&M. So, but I think winning at home matters. So I'm going to put Auburn or Mississippi State at two, and then maybe A&M at three.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that's fair because I was going to have at Ole Miss and then Missouri, then Mississippi State
and,
for me.
And then Missouri's got to be up there because, like we've talked about, you're likely going to be playing for something of consequence. Are you sure? You sure as hell hope you are.
Yeah.
At that point in the year.
Yeah.
Because if not, that means you're at four wins. If that game's of no consequence, that means you're at no better than four wins.
Yeah.
So that'd be really disappointing.
Yeah, that's the last thing you want to do, having that game in Little Rock and everything involved with it, that you're not playing for anything except for, oh,
well,
that
that's
would be
the
your
case. What
game.
Would the crowd be like?
Drunk.
Well, not that, but I mean, 30,000, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know.
It would not be good. It would not be good overall. So, but yeah, that's an interesting conversation here with those key games. I think they're all key games in the SEC for sure, but Arkansas really, really needs a few of these more so than anything else.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Like the Bud Light Morning Rush podcast? Check out the Halftime Pod at hitthatline.com.